It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Ascalon State Park has a rich history. We'll talk to an archaeologist leading a special event open to the public. We'll learn more in just a bit.
First, this morning's shooting at a Republican congressional baseball practice injured five people, including House Majority Whip Steve Scalise from Louisiana. President Trump and congressional leaders from both parties called for prayer and solidarity in the aftermath of that attack. Here's the president speaking earlier today.
We may have our differences, but we do well in times like these to remember that everyone who serves in our nation's capital is here because, above all, they love our country. We can all agree that we are blessed to be Americans, that our children deserve to grow up in a nation of safety and peace, and that we are strongest when we are unified and when we work together for the common good.
While details are still coming out, it appears that the suspect, who died from wounds sustained during the shootout, had posted anti-Trump and anti-Republican statements on social media and had faced charges for domestic battery in the past.
He had volunteered for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Senator Sanders denounced the attack today on the Senate floor, saying, "I am sickened by this despicable act," and calling for nonviolence in politics.
Brian Levin joins us now. He studies extremist violence in politics. He's a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And last time we talked, Brian, you had three areas of concern when it comes to the causes of extremist violence: the Salafist jihadist movement in the Islamic world, white nationalism, and you said you were worried that we were on the verge of seeing violence from the hard left in the United States. With that in mind, what do you make of today's attack based on what we know at this point?
That this is an example of hard left violence. And I've been going up and down the state of California. I just came back from Sacramento. Last month, I spoke to officials in L.A., and the L.A. Daily News, their headline said, "As hate crimes rise in L.A., new report says hard left actions also pose threat." We came out with a report last month where we discussed this threat of an emergent hard left violent fringe. And it's coming home to roost.
What were the warning signs you were seeing that appear to have come to fruition today?
Great question. And it's a bunch of the things that we saw in other extremist movements as well. A coarse kind of discourse on social media, for instance. We also saw in California alone, since December 2015, over 20 violent public political street demonstrations that turned out violent, where we saw in the triple digits the number of people who were arrested or referred for charges, multiple injuries, and it was up and down the state. People are saying, "Oh, it's Berkeley." A quarter of these events occurred in Orange County, California, which is just south of L.A. So we saw this kind of bubbling up of these violent public battles. And then we saw as well the emergence of organizing for violent means that was proactive and not necessarily a response to some choreographed internet battle that erupted at a street demonstration. In other words, what I'm saying is there are folks out there on the hard left who have splintered off from the progressive mainstream, like the Women's March, which is completely peaceful, and they're looking for people to undertake violence with them, and they're openly talking about it and openly recruiting for it and trying to vet out those who reject violence.
Is there a common theme when we're talking about violence on the right or violence on the left that would allow us to prevent both of them?
Well, there's certainly a common theme. I'll get to prevention in a second. But what we've seen over the last, and thank you for remembering what I said the last time I was on, over the last five decades, in the early to mid-60s, trust in government was at 77%. It has plummeted now to under 20%. So we're seeing this anti-establishment, anti-elitist type of violence, which spans the political spectrum. So, for instance, the Portland killer. He briefly supported Bernie Sanders because he was anti-establishment. So some of this relates to tactics as opposed to ideology. And this is something that I think we're going to see more of, unfortunately. We're seeing this tectonic shift where we have a democratization of extremism and these fault lines now intersect. So what they're doing is, on the hard left, they're looking at two things. One, they believe that the kind of violence that took place at Trump rallies against dissenters needed to be responded to, and they're using the playbook not only from some violent folks in the alt-right, but also from historical folks who were involved in this kind of activity in the late late '60s and early '70s, when we're at a point of political polarization and tribalism, and people believe resistance is important. We now have on the hard left folks who believe that violence is acceptable and it's being mainstreamed. There are even folks in academia and elsewhere that says it's okay, that say this is okay as part of a progressive movement. And it started with things like, you know, punch a Nazi when Richard Spencer was punched while he was being interviewed in D.C. And now we're seeing these kinds of rhetorical depictions, for instance, of President Trump being killed. This is not good for democracy.
Brian, I know you have another appointment. We'll leave it there, but I'm sure we'll talk again before too long. Thanks for joining us.
As always, thank you.
That's Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino.
Well, this morning's shooting has dominated the conversation in Washington, D.C. A number of other stories are still developing in national politics, including special elections, a Senate effort to write a health care bill, and lessons from elections in France and the U.K.
Harry Enten is with us now for our weekly look at the latest national news. He's a senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. Harry, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, I know the story this morning is overshadowing a lot of other things, but there are a lot of other things going on. I want to start. You were up late last night following the results of this election in Virginia, primaries in both parties, Harry.
Yeah, there were primaries in both parties, and I think the main story coming out of the primaries is once again that Democratic enthusiasm is just through the roof. So many more people voted in the Democratic primary for governor in Virginia, which has traditionally been a swing state, than voted in the Republican primary. And that's just something we've seen across the board, where Democratic voters seem very enthusiastic. They want to come out and vote in these off-year elections, and that forebodes pretty good for them in the midterm elections when turnout is such a key important factor.
And in both of those primaries, you had two candidates with very distinctive differences. Can you sum up kind of what was at stake within the Democratic side and then the Republican side?
Yeah, you know, on the Democratic side, I think a lot of people thought that it might be a difference between, say, a Bernie Sanders and a Hillary Clinton wing, but that's not exactly the way I would define it. The way I would define it is that Ralph Northam, who's the lieutenant governor in that state, had the backing of the establishment within the state of Virginia, while Tom Perriello, a former congressman, had the backing of national Democratic leaders, including Bernie Sanders. And Ralph Northam was able to come out ahead by a pretty substantial margin, a little over 10 percentage points, which I think just comes back to the basic idea that intrastate support matters a lot. State parties are very important in politics, and that's why it's important for Democrats going forward in the midterm elections to build strong state parties, because they are the ones who drive get-out-the-vote efforts. On the Republican side, you know, I'll just tell you, the state of Virginia and the Republican voters in that state have changed tremendously. Ed Gillespie, who is the former Republican National Committee chairman, barely squeaked by Corey Stewart, who was the former Trump campaign head in that state. Stewart is far to the right, and I think it's just a great example of how voters right now on the Republican side have shifted to the right. Formerly moderate Republicans have pretty much become independents or even shifted into the Democratic column.
Moving to another special election. This one's coming up next Tuesday now, this runoff in a congressional seat in Georgia. What is the polling showing you there, Harry?
Well, you know, I'll tell you that this is probably, you know, we've heard about all these special elections so far on the House level. I think this is the kit and caboodle, the big ball game. John Ossoff, who's the Democratic candidate, 30-year-old, is trying to win in this district that was previously very Republican, but one that Donald Trump won by just over a percentage point in 2016. The polling suggests that Ossoff does have a lead, but a very slight advantage. It's 3 points in polls conducted in the month of June. So really anything could happen there, but Ossoff is a slight favorite. And if he wins, I think Democrats will breathe a sigh of relief given how much money, it's the most expensive House race in the history of the United States.
Yeah, speaking of interstate support, there's a lot of out-of-state money from both sides flowing in here, right?
Oh, there is a ton of money flowing from out-of-state to both sides. Democrats are very much involved in this. You know, a family member who's a big Democrat asked me if John Ossoff needed any more money, and I said, are you insane? I mean, there's just so much money. Money was not an issue in this campaign. Both sides got their messages out, and that's why I think it's a pretty good test case. If Democrats can win there, then it's a good indication that they may be able to take back the House in 2018. If Republicans are able to hold on, Democrats may have to rethink their message.
Right. There have been other special elections where Democrats lost, but they could say, but we really outperformed past expectations. If they lose here, even if they outperform past performances, this seems like a wind out of their sails moment.
I would definitely think so. This is a fair playing ground, I think, for Democrats. This district looks like the types of districts that they'll need to win in 2018 if they want to take back the House, and they've certainly had the money and the support that's been necessary behind John Ossoff. Ossoff should win this if it's a sign that Democrats are going to take back the House. They may take back the House anyway, even if Ossoff loses, but this is the type of district where they want to win.
We're talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about some of the latest news in national politics.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you watching the special elections around the country? Have you donated to a candidate maybe in another state? How do you think the Russia investigation could affect the political landscape? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Harry Enten from 538, looking at some of the top stories in national politics.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching special elections around the country? Are they tea leaves worth reading? What are you looking for? What do you think about the latest news in the Russia investigation, the Attorney General Sessions testimony yesterday? And are you watching politics in other countries, in the United Kingdom and France? Anything we should be watching for or learning from that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go across the pond for a minute, Harry. We had these parliamentary elections in both United Kingdom and France. Let's start in the UK. Labour lost, but did better than people were expecting just a month ago. What happened there?
I think this is a great example in the UK where, as you mentioned, Labour lost but came much closer than anyone expected. The politics can change in an instant. The Conservative Party, Theresa May, they had the majority in the government. They called a snap election, which was set for just a few months from when she called it, and her lead evaporated. And, you know, I think it's very difficult not to connect the dots that Theresa May was pretty friendly with Donald Trump, and we've seen this throughout elections since Trump was elected in Western Europe. The candidates who are most friendly with Donald Trump have seen their polling numbers decline. And, you know, correlation isn't always causation, but the fact now it's happened in six different countries, I believe. We have an article up on the website. My colleague Nate Silver put one up. And it just does seem that parties that are tied with Donald Trump seem to do worse than you'd expect, given where they started at the beginning of the campaign.
You pointed out an analogy between this election and last year's presidential election, where in the U.S. there were about statistically three even alternatives: narrow Donald Trump victory, narrow Clinton victory, Clinton landslide. In the U.K., three options: Tory, Conservative landslide, narrow Tory win, Labour outperforming, something like that. But, you know, what does that say about polling and prediction?
Well, you know, I think that this is something, you know, that I've certainly been working on since last year's presidential election, and something I hope people in our industry are generally working on, is trying to convey to the reading public and the general public that polls are tools. They're not perfect predictions, otherwise we wouldn't actually hold elections. And I think, you know, personally speaking on our own half, I think we did a pretty good job in that instance, but I'm not quite sure that people over in the UK did a particularly good job. I think that there were far too many people who expected a UK landslide, just like too many people in the United States expected a Hillary Clinton landslide last year, despite what the polling was actually saying, which suggested a close election. And I'm hopeful that in the future, both here and abroad, We just pare back. We don't try and give the public too much of an expectation of what might happen.
Now, in France, a new president there from a party that didn't exist, a year ago. His party in the first round of elections appears to be on course to have a massive majority in parliament there. What do we make of this out-of-nowhere centrist party, decline of the left party, big decline in the far-right party? What do you make of that, Harry?
You know, it's kind of difficult to necessarily make too much of it. You know, it's almost as someone said, if there was a combination of Mike Bloomberg and Mark Zuckerberg managed to win, you know, a presidential election here and then created a landslide in the House of Representatives. Emmanuel Macron, who was the centrist candidate, founded his own party. I guess what I would say is that France is another example where the hard right was turned back, but it's not as clear of a case, so much of an instance where the left is necessarily ascendant, but it does seem to me to suggest that there is certainly something going on in Western Europe once again, whereby, you know, the fact that Macron's party got the largest majority in the French National Assembly since de Gaulle back in the 60s, I think says something that, you know, far-right politics is not that popular when you present a alternative that is not the second least liked candidate of all time as Hillary Clinton was in 2016.
Let's bring it back to this side of the Atlantic now with a caller. Matthew is with us in Hazelhurst. Matthew, hi.
Hi, how you doing? My question was about Jeff Sessions and a little bit about Donald Trump. When they're asked questions about, you know, you want a yes or a no answer, you know, they have all these tricks. They have the, you know, you're saying, well, I don't recall. I don't, you know, they have all the little tricks. And they never really answer a question. And for me personally, it frustrates the, you know, what out of me. And, you know, these are the people that are supposed to represent us, and they don't give us any clear answers.
Matthew, thanks for the call. So Attorney General Sessions, Harry, of course, all eyes on him testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday. Nothing huge came out of that. What did you make of all that?
Yeah, I don't think anything necessarily huge came out of that. I thought Jeff Sessions acquitted himself fairly well, which I don't think is too surprising, given that Sessions was, you know, a 20-year veteran in the United States Senate. And, you know, as Attorney General knows how to argue his case. The one thing I will say that to me was rather interesting was that Sessions, in most points, really didn't make anything that James Comey said last week seem false. And, of course, Comey made Trump look quite bad, and there were certainly some beliefs that James Comey does believe that Donald Trump, although he didn't say it, was guilty of a obstruction of justice. So the fact that Sessions didn't necessarily come off as bad, you know, is good news for him, but I'm not necessarily sure his testimony was good for the Trump administration at large, because it does suggest that the Robert Mueller investigation, special prosecutor, will continue to go forward, and there's nothing, at least in Sessions' testimony, to believe that they'll find anything false that James Comey said last week.
Matthew, thanks for that call. Harry, as this Russia investigation chugs along, and there's a lot of different angles here, not all of them even pointed toward the Trump campaign itself, do you have any indication in polling whether, you know, people are worried about this, whether it's affecting things like President Trump's approval?
Oh, you know, it's kind of interesting. People certainly don't list it as a top concern in the poll. Something like healthcare ranks far higher. But it does seem to be the case, if you look at when Donald Trump's approval rating goes up or goes down, that when he fired James Comey, it was probably not the best news for his approval rating, that it did cause some decline in it. And in fact, what you see in our polling, which we sponsored, that was done by SurveyMonkey, is we see that a lot of those people who voted for Donald Trump last year, but didn't do so because they liked him, they did it because they didn't like Hillary Clinton, they want this special counsel and the special prosecutor to go forward with his investigation, Robert Mueller. So, you know, I think it does have an effect, and if Trump tries to get in the way of the investigation, it could turn out quite negatively for him.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about some of the top stories in national politics. You mentioned there, Harry, health care, a top concern for a lot of people, no surprise. The Senate, the U.S. Senate, a group of Republican senators are working on a new plan behind closed doors, not releasing drafts, apparently no public hearings on this. President Trump apparently told senators the U.S. House plan was mean. We're going to talk more about this later in the show, but briefly, what are people thinking about health care? What is the public looking at?
Well, I mean, the public hates this plan. I mean, if you just look across any polls, you'll see that. It's far less popular than Obamacare. If you look, our friends over at the Upshot at the New York Times, they published a piece that showed that more people dislike the health care plan, the Republican alternative, than Obamacare in every single state. It's unbelievable how unpopular this is. If Republicans go forward, good luck to them. But to me, it's the type of thing that could end up an electoral disaster, given how many people dislike this bill and how important people have been ranking health care in terms of the top issues.
One outcome people have pointed toward is maybe a bill that in the Senate could bring the Senate moderate Republicans or Republicans in maybe endangered seats on board, but then wouldn't appeal to conservatives in the House. So you end up with, I guess, nothing?
I think at the end of the day, I'm not going to discount Republicans' chances of getting anything. But obviously, if the Senate passes a different bill than the House, then they'll have to, you know, reconvene together and they'll have to vote on one bill as its final thing. We'll see. I think a lot of people doubted that the House could get a health care bill passed after it failed the first time. So I'm not going to doubt that they could pass an entire bill. But certainly it's a difficult sort of tippy toe where they're going to have to, you know, it's probably going to come down to the last votes in each body.
And, Harry, you mentioned the president's approval ratings. What is the latest news from that?
It continues to tick downward. You know, Donald Trump and Gallup yesterday, for instance, hit a 60% disapproval rating. Barack Obama never was that unpopular during his time. It's quite unbelievable how unpopular Donald Trump is. Now, could he recover? Of course he could recover. But the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump is just not a popular candidate right now, a popular president right now, and a lot of the things he pushes for are not that popular, and the main reason he won last year was because he managed to find someone who also wasn't very popular to run against. But in the 2018 midterms are almost always referendums on the president, and that's why I think a lot of us expect the Republicans are going to struggle bigly next year.
And your colleague Nate Silver, I think, was the one who wrote that there seems to be some movement from strongly approving of President Trump among his supporters to just approving, but without that strong approval.
Yeah, and I think that this is rather key, is it's not, you know, among Donald Trump's base, what we see is they may still like him, but they don't like him as much. You know, they don't hate him, but they don't like him as much. And to me, that's important because, again, going back to what we spoke about at the beginning of this conversation, turnout is so important in midterm elections. And even if these people aren't going to vote Democratic, if they don't feel a strong inclination towards Donald Trump and a strong inclination to vote for the Republican brand, they may not turn out at all. And that could be very bad for Republicans.
Harry, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com in our weekly review of national politics.